The World is supported by Israel Story, a podcast that tells extraordinary stories about regular people living in Israel, the kind you won't see on the news or online. The show kicked off season four with a miniseries called The Wall, beginning with the gorgeous tale of a Jewish Arab baby born at the Western Wall in the middle of the Six-Day War. Hosted by Mishy Harman and brought to you by Tablet Magazine and PRX. Subscribe to Israel Story on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, israelstory.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The U.S. brokered a five-day ceasefire in northern Syria, but people there say that's not what they got. They could hear gunshots the whole time.
There's this sort of exasperation and feeling of absurdity of the whole situation.
And now with a new deal between Turkey and Russia, uncertainty rules. Also today, up north, Canadian voters give Prime Minister Justin Trudeau another chance.
We will continue to fight climate change. We will get guns off our streets, and we will keep investing in Canadians.
And the World Series starts tonight with a merengue beat and plenty of Latino firepower. The Washington Nationals arriving there at the ballpark. Fans in the Dominican Republic will be watching their hometown heroes on baseball's biggest stage. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Russia and Turkey say they have reached a historic agreement on Syria. Turkey will get a safe zone inside Syria, an east-west strip that will extend 20 miles from the Turkish border. That strip will have three segments. Turkish troops will occupy the central section. Russian and Syrian forces will occupy sections on the east and west. Kurdish fighters must leave the entire area. The agreement was announced after a marathon 6 hours of talks between Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin in the Russian Olympic city of Sochi. Ceylan Erzan Erişan is consul general in Boston for the Republic of Turkey. How happy is Turkey with this agreement?
Well, I think it's too soon for me to comment on that, about the details of the agreement, but I can definitely say that it's a huge step in Turkey's broader efforts in cleaning up the terrorists from its borders, first thing, and even broader aims to establish security, safety, integrity, and unity of Syria.
Does this mark the end of offensive military operations by Turkey inside Syria?
Well, the aims of the military operation is to eliminate a long-standing terror threat against Turkey's national security and to enforce Syria's territorial integrity and unity, as I said in my first sentence. So until those aims are finally reached, and if we have more terror attacks from the Syrian territory, then the military operation, I believe, will restart.
So you're talking about the terrorists belonging to the PKK, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
But not the YPG, which is the group that was being supported alongside the American troops.
No, well, for us, I mean, we have been emphasizing to the international media for a very long time that YPG and PKK are definitely the same two things.
And yet they are not the same two things.
They're the same things. YPG is PKK's offshoot in Syria.
But YPG has not staged attacks to change the political situation in Turkey.
But YPG has been staging attacks in Turkey. So they
what is the evidence
PKK
of that?
PKK and YPG, they both have the same military command. They're parts of the same structure.
I mean, so, there's a lot of concern on the Kurdish side that it's precisely this conflation of the PKK with the YPG that is making a lot of concerns and worries about possible ethnic cleansing. I mean,
well,
that's what is the concern of the Kurdish commander, Mazlum Kobani.
Yeah, I mean, these are the claims that we have been listening enough, and the other aims of the military operation, the peace operation, is to liberate the local population from PYD and YPG oppression. They've been oppressing all the ethnic groups in their territory. This is clearly a terrorist group. And also, we would like to set the ground for safe and voluntary returns of Syrians in Turkey, the number of which is around 300,000.
We'll get to that in a moment. Let me just get back to this belief on the part of the Kurdish commander that Turkey's planning ethnic cleansing. What assurances can Turkey give to Kurdish civilians who live in this border area
that won't happen? Which Kurdish general
is that? That's Mazlum Kobani.
Yeah, he's a wanted terrorist in Turkey for 29 years, so I'm not going to comment about his claims.
What about the civilians, the Kurdish civilians who are concerned about this as well?
Who are those Kurdish civilians that I don't know, but Turkey is working on the ground with the United Nations agencies and with all the actors to provide safety and security of all the populations, Kurds and Arabs and other ethnic minorities alike on the ground. So these claims are completely baseless.
You know the example, though, of the district of Afrin in northwest Syria. It was occupied by Turkey in March of last year, and the Kurdish population fled and has not been allowed to return. So what do you call that?
No, this is not correct. And I really don't know where you're getting all those ethnic cleansing claims.
Well reported.
I don't know about those reports and who are preparing them. But the Syrian National Coalition, who are the legitimate representatives of the Syrian people, the interim government, the tribal leaders, the minorities, including the Christian communities, are all supportive of the Turkish military operation.
Apparently, there are plans from President Erdogan to move even more Syrians who are currently inside Turkey back into this new safe zone in Syria.
Of course, they should be returning to their homelands.
Right, yeah. And that might not equate to ethnic cleansing, but it is a big demographic transformation, isn't it?
No, it's not a demographic transformation. These people were already flooding into Turkey, escaping from the violence in their own country. And Turkey has been hosting them, has been opening its arms to provide their all needs and to provide them a humane life. And there are 3.6 million of them in Turkey at the moment. And of course, most of them, they would like to return back to their homes. And Turkey will be providing this by the end of the operation, we hope.
Ceylan Erzan Erişan is Consul General of the Republic of Turkey in Boston. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now a voice from inside Syria. Dani Ellis has been working in Kurdish-controlled areas of northern Syria for the past 10 months. She's a 29-year-old British citizen who volunteered to help the Kurds. In recent weeks, she's been part of three convoys trying to reach injured people caught in the fighting. We reached her in Tel Tamir, just a few miles from the front lines, where she says residents are preparing for the worst.
Tarpaulin has been going up to cover the streets. Tires have been gathered in strategic places around the city so that they can be set on fire to cover the sky with a thick black smoke. And a lot of people have been preparing. They've been preparing their homes, packing their things up in case they need to make a quick getaway.
So those tarpaulins, I gather, that's not for shelter. That's for something else, correct?
This is so that aircraft can't see who is moving in the streets. There was in Serikani last week, just over a week ago now, I think, a civilian convoy drove, much like the one that I was part of, drove into the city to pick up the wounded, and it was hit by an airstrike. And they're very keen for this kind of thing not to happen again and are covering as many streets as possible so that these convoys, their fighters, civilians fleeing, no one can be seen from the sky, so can't be targeted anywhere near as easily.
So was that targeting going on during this 5-day pause in hostilities?
Absolutely. The convoys I was on, the first one was fired upon and we turned back. The second one I was on, there was new positions on the side of the road that seemed to be aiming at us, so we turned back. The third one was fine. We managed to get through into the city, but we spoke to the fighters inside the city and they told us that the only time the bombing and the shelling and the attacks with heavy weapons directly on the hospital inside the city had eased up was when our convoy was coming in.
Right. So whatever it's being called, a ceasefire or a pause in the hostilities, it doesn't sound like it actually happened over the past 5 days.
No. When I was on the first two of these convoys, I personally witnessed shelling hitting the city. Some shells landed near us, which we believed were perhaps warning shots. You could hear the thuds. You could see the smoke rising in Serikani itself. And there was without a doubt shells falling, heavy weapons being used.
So once you are kind of getting some of these people out of this this area, I mean, you're speaking with them. What's the morale among the Kurds that you've met?
The Kurdish people are very defiant. And they know war very well. They've lived under it. Most of them have lived under it their whole lives in various different ways. They're very good at keeping up a fighting spirit, whether it means going to war, whether it means dealing with the home front, whether it means digging their friends and their family out of destroyed buildings. They just get on with it. But at the same time, for them, they thought, well, they were certainly expecting Serikani or Ras al Ain to be a sort of Kobani moment, I think, Kobani being the city that in 2014 held out against ISIS right until the end and then made a heroic comeback.
Danny, I mean, you've spoken with these fighters. Introduce us to one of them and what's going on in their head right now.
I can talk about one I met in the hospital the other day when we got into this hospital, and it'd been our third attempt, the first successful attempt since the convoy that had been hit by an airstrike. And there were three guys, they were standing by the entrance. They were sort of watching us come in. They were very subdued, just watching us. I went over and asked them jokingly how their situation was. And, you know, one of them laughed, the other two didn't seem particularly happy with me. But we got chatting and they showed me their wounds. They all had gunshot wounds, one in the arm, both the others in their leg. You know, they told me that they killed a lot of these Turkish-backed Islamist forces that had been surrounding the hospital. They'd been hitting armored vehicles. They'd survived airstrikes. They'd survived the war for the last 2 weeks. They were quite badly injured. One of them couldn't really walk very well. Yeah, and when I said to them, well, we've got this convoy here now. We've come to take you back to Tana. They didn't want to come. And these guys were bandaged up, but they still had their weapons. And they that night, at least, they refused to come. That, to me, spoke volumes.
How do you explain that defiance, though, in the face of this powerful Turkish army?
They fought so hard for so many decades to carve out some semblance of self-determination. And they're not going to give it up. They've tasted freedom. They've tasted self-determination. And it was extremely hard won. The scale of destruction that they experienced in the fight against ISIS was similar to the scale of destruction that Britain experienced during the Second World War. They're not easily going to give up what they've won. And why should they?
Danny, thank you very much for your time. Good to speak with you. Stay safe.
You're welcome.
Danny Ellis is a British citizen who has been working in Kurdish-controlled areas in northern Syria for the past 10 months. We reached her in Tel Tamar, just a few miles from the front line of fighting. These are the first steps up the sheer face of a cliff.
He just started climbing.
That's from the film Free Solo, about American climber Alex Honnold's quest to conquer El Capitan in Yosemite National Park in California. That'd be like climbing almost three Empire State Buildings, and Alex did it with no ropes, no harness, and no audience besides a film crew. Pretty different than the climb that just happened in China. That's the start of the speed climbing finals at the Sports World Cup event in Xiamen, China. Going head-to-head were Indonesia's Aries Susanti Rahayu and China's Yiling Song. And what happened next happened really fast. Both climbers shot off the floor and bounded up a 50-foot wall. They looked like squirrels racing up a tree.
Oh, she got away well, but then Song stumbled almost immediately. What can Aries Susanti Rahayu do? She's going absolutely full tilt. She's breaking the world record. Aries Susanti Rahayu, the first woman of the 7 seconds.
And yep, that was it. The entire climb over in 6.9 seconds. A new world record set by 24-year-old Susanti Rahayu. About 3 hours, 55 minutes, and 53 seconds quicker than Alex Honnold's climb in Yosemite. Honnold's nickname is no big deal. In the speed climbing world, Susanti Rahayu is known as Spider Woman. After the race, she showed some of her battle scars to Indonesian news outlet The Star, a broken finger and nagging hand injuries.
I'm very happy. Amazing for me. And then my condition is not good. You can look my hand, my finger, but in place, I can new record. Wow, amazing for me.
Yeah, I would say. You can see video of Aries' historic climb on our website, theworld.org. Just don't blink or you might miss it. And later in the show, a much slower sport. The World Series starts tonight. For Dominican fans, a 20-year-old from Santo Domingo will be at the center of it all.
Soto, long ball to left. See you later.
Stick around for that. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. Laws are changing in a major way in Northern Ireland. Yesterday, the country decriminalized abortion and legalized same-sex marriage.
Hiya, Amanda McGurk here, calling from Belfast. I'm here with my partner, Cara McCann.
My name is Cara McCann. I'm here with my partner, Amanda McGurk.
Why is this meaningful to myself and Cara? Well, We have felt like second-class citizens.
People in the north of Ireland are waking up today and their families feeling a little bit more equal.
We're absolutely delighted.
Weddings are scheduled to start in February. Cara McCann and Amanda McGurk, whom we just heard from, hope to be one of the first couples to tie the knot. Northern Ireland now joins the rest of the UK in legalizing same-sex marriage. The other major change on abortion means that services will be in line with the rest of the UK and that women will no longer have to travel to England. Which might have you wondering, how is it that Northern Ireland has different laws from, say, Scotland, England and Wales if they're all part of the UK?
That's not easy to explain because it's a really crazy time here.
Susan McKay is an Irish writer who is a veteran of the women's movement, and she joins us from just outside Belfast. How is it that Northern Ireland's laws can be different from the rest of the UK?
Well, Northern Ireland is in a complex relationship with the United Kingdom, and that relationship has been even more complicated over the last couple of years because we had the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, and that led to the setting up of an executive in Northern Ireland, a devolved executive. So it was part of the British government, but it was devolved, so it had certain powers of its own. But unfortunately, that assembly broke down and hasn't sat for a couple of years now. So Northern Ireland is in this strange political limbo where it doesn't have a government. So what has happened is that this summer, the British government was in the middle of passing a piece of legislation which was sort of a holding exercise just to say, yes, yes, we know Northern Ireland needs a government. We haven't got one right now, but everything is going to be fine. And instead, a number of MPs who were very sympathetic to human rights campaigns in Northern Ireland stepped in and held debates and then inserted clauses which said we are going to have same-sex marriage and abortion. Those would previously have been regarded as devolved issues, which is to say that the Northern Ireland government should have made decisions about them. But since we don't have one, Westminster was able to step in.
Mm. So, Susan, that's kind of the brief history of the differences. But if we look back over the years, how has abortion figured into these divides?
Well, abortion has always been a very controversial issue. And up until just a few years ago, all of the main political parties in Northern Ireland were opposed to abortion in any circumstances. But over the last few years, particularly because of changes in the Republic, which now has quite a liberal abortion regime, public attitudes have changed in Northern Ireland. But the Democratic Unionist Party hasn't really. And yesterday we had the DUP calling back the Northern Ireland Assembly in a last minute effort to try to stop the Westminster law. But that wasn't successful because they didn't have a nationalist party willing to go in with them on it.
So what are the circumstances at this point by which abortion and same-sex marriage will actually become law in Northern Ireland?
Well, regulations will now be brought in so that the law is fully organised according to acceptable principles, which are in line with the rest of the UK. So it won't be just a free-for-all where anybody and everybody can just do what they want. But the situation at the moment, for example, is that there is a woman who's facing court because she bought online abortion pills for her 16-year-old daughter who was in an abusive relationship with an older man, and the daughter had become pregnant. And when the mother got involved with the health authorities in Northern Ireland, they reported her to the authorities and she was actually arrested and charged with an offence. So it's not a theoretical situation here. It's a very serious one.
Susan McKay, an Irish writer and activist, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
There's another hot-button topic in other parts of the UK around sex and gender. In Birmingham, England, people are protesting outside of schools over whether children should be taught about LGBT relationships. A year from now, relationship education will be required in elementary schools across England and Wales. The BBC's Seema Kotecha reports from one school in northeast London that already has lessons on social differences in its curriculum.
What do we mean when we say LGBT? What does it mean to you that we get to learn about that?
Teacher Becca Whittaker asks her class of 10 and 11-year-olds.
I mean, I just think it's really good that we get to learn this stuff in our school so that everyone knows that it's okay to be gay, it's okay to be lesbian. sometimes if you don't learn about LGBT, you might like go against it and be like, that's you can't do that.
At Queensbridge Primary, the school believes it's paramount that children are taught about diversity in society, and that includes different relationships and faiths.
What type of religions do we practice in our country?
Hinduism, Buddhism, Islamic, Judaism and Christianity.
Here they learn about it all from adults with experience, like Dipti Moj.
I was brought up as a Hindu, so we practice the Hindu religion. And some of you mentioned some of the festivals that we would celebrate. So,
as part of the diversity mantra, people of various faiths come in to tell their stories.
As a teenager, I knew I was different because I also am a lesbian. At school, we didn't talk about it. It wasn't people telling us that it was okay to be a lesbian or to be gay or to be a lesbian and be Hindu. So it was very, very hard for me.
And by doing this, the school argues it's sending out a firm message. Embrace difference and don't be frightened of it.
We get so much hatred, and I think it's really nice when in a school, the school can embrace people's differences and create joy.
Do you think the children need to be aware that there are people of various faiths who don't think homosexuality is morally right?
No, unfortunately, I think our children are already aware of those perspectives. I think they hear them, so equally they should have the opportunity to hear another perspective.
But there has been pushback, with some parents demanding their children don't take part in lessons about LGBT relationships. Sarah Bailey is the head teacher.
Our community is made up by very many different cultures, religions, ethnicity.
What do you say to those parents who don't want their children to be in those classes?
We are building them up for British values and what it means to be a citizen in our society.
The government recently said it was keen on schools to have discussions with people of different faiths in the light of the recent protests outside schools in Birmingham. But views are passionate and often entrenched, and what could work in one classroom might not in another.
I've learned it's always, always important to respect someone no matter who they are, no matter what religion it is, and that people have different religions, and that's nothing to make a fuss about.
Children in London talking about their school's new inclusive curriculum with the BBC's Seema Kotecha. You're with the world. The music of Aretha Franklin came out of the Baptist Church. The music of Cuba's Daime Arocena has its roots in the Santeria faith.
Because it's so rich, it's so tasty, it has a lot of rhythms, it has a lot of melodies.
Connecting with believers and non-believers through music, that's still coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman, you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. The five-day ceasefire in northeast Syria has officially expired. The Trump administration helped broker that truce. David Eubank is in northern Syria, just a few miles from the front lines. He heads the humanitarian group Free Burma Rangers and is a former U.S. Army Special Forces soldier. Eubank is embedded with the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurdish fighters known as the SDF. He's helping to evacuate wounded Kurdish civilians and fighters. He says he has not experienced anything like a ceasefire in recent days.
The ground attack has continued every day, and they're being guided by Turkish drones that fly over us. A few hours ago, there was an attack at a position in front of us. Last night, there was an attack in a position in front of us. They lost the position, the SDF did, and had a wounded man trapped, hiding. We went to try to get him out, and we were almost surrounded, fired up by the Free Syrian Army. We got out. It became dark, and then we went around looking for him, which took about 5 hours, bumping into the Free Syrian Army, and there was little firefights. And he came crawling down the road, shot through the thigh, close to midnight, and we found him and drug him back, put him in our ambulance, you know, no lights on, and got him back. He's alive. So that's what we're seeing. And most of the villagers have displaced and have fled. Over 300,000 displaced people now in this northeast part of Syria.
And that man that you rescued, would he have been a Kurdish fighter?
Yes, he was a Kurdish fighter.
Dave, have you had to return fire defensively, or is your only concern getting the injured and anyone in harm's way out of the hostilities?
Well, our main concern, we're not there to fight anyone. And our main concern is to get people out of hostilities. But sometimes, as yesterday, if we did not return fire, they would have killed all of us. They were surrounding us. They had two Humvees they'd captured with heavy machine guns. They had a Jeep with heavy machine gun. They had about 40 infantry, and there was eight of us, and they had us on three sides, and they were just gunning us down and moving towards us. But because I had the rear element suppress, shoot back, I was able to get everybody back in the vehicles, and we took off out of there.
Have you been attacked directly by the Turkish military? I mean, can Turkey claim that they have somehow been observing this five-day pause?
I think Turkey can claim that they haven't done any airstrikes, because I have not seen any airstrikes by Turkey. So I think that's the game they're playing, is saying we're not doing any airstrikes and we can't control the Free Syrian Army, which is completely false. And so they're letting the Free Syrian Army kill the Kurds and take up more and more space.
Sounds like the Kurds are seriously outnumbered.
Seriously outnumbered, yes. The Turkish military is one of the larger ones in the world. They're a NATO force. They have night vision. They have thermal. They've got F-16s that we sold them. They've got attack helicopters. They have tanks. They are a seriously formidable military. And they're pushing the Free Syrian Army up ahead of them. And there's Turkish special forces out in front as well. It's hard to distinguish who they are, but they're also doing terminal guidance on airstrikes.
So we know what happened to the U.S. military. Donald Trump ordered them to leave. What should the U.S. military do? I mean, they're some miles to the east there in western Iraq.
Well, they should defend people. And I'm sure the people in the military want to do their job of defending their friends, keeping ISIS contained and not allowing invaders and keeping dictators out. That's what the military should do. I think what the U.S. government should do, our president should do, is say, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, please forgive me. We are going to stand with you. We're going to draw a new line, and we're going to compromise. I made a big mistake. Let's try to do something and bring something good out of it. And the Kurds must be at that bargaining table.
Do you have any
hope? The only way to guarantee that is with U.S. troop presence. And then U.S. cannot solve the problem. We can't, but we can create a space where Arabs and Kurds and Christians and Yazidis and others can work something out, which they were doing in northeast Syria.
David Eubank there, speaking with us a few miles from the front lines in northern Syria. He's a former U.S. Army Special Forces operative who heads now a humanitarian group known as the Free Burma Rangers. Canadian voters have spoken. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will hold onto his seat in Ottawa after yesterday's election.
You are sending our Liberal team back to work, back to Ottawa with a clear mandate. We will make life more affordable. We will continue to fight climate change. We will get guns off our streets, and we will keep investing in Canadians.
But that clear mandate Trudeau said he got from voters, not so clear. His Liberal Party won just a third of the popular vote. Still, in a parliamentary system like Canada's, that was enough to hold onto power. But it means that Trudeau must now work with smaller parties to govern. Here to explain how politics work up north is reporter Emma Jacobs in Montreal. So Trudeau now leads this minority government. What does that mean strategically for him?
So he fell just short of a majority. So he's going to have to either build coalitions formally or vote by vote to get legislation passed. It's not going to be impossible for him, but he's going to have to do more diplomacy with other parties and also to hold on to members of his own who may feel some disenchantment with his leadership.
Is the closest analogy here in the U.S. probably like Nancy Pelosi suddenly finding herself having to govern alongside Mitch McConnell?
We're in a multi-party system here, so assuming he can work with the NDP, the New Democrats, Trudeau gets over that majority that he needs in Parliament to pass legislation. So he doesn't necessarily need the Conservatives, their support. The third parties that they're more likely to ally themselves with are the NDP, potentially the Greens. The Bloc Québécois, they're opportunists. They'll vote if they think something is good for Quebec, but they don't like Trudeau personally. They didn't even like his father. So you could see things getting contentious.
You've mentioned the progressive NDP and the Bloc Québécois. Let's start with the NDP, led by Jagmeet Singh. They lost seats, but is it possible they'll be in a stronger position than before because Trudeau's going to have to now do business with this smaller party?
Yeah, it's funny. They lost a lot of seats, almost half. But because the NDP can push the Liberals over the majority on votes, they could actually be going into this new parliament with more influence than they had before. The NDP is likely to push Trudeau on a couple of issues, on the environment, and generally they lean to more social spending.
So Trudeau's main challenger, Andrew Scheer of the Conservative Party, won the popular vote but did not win as many seats as the Liberals. So explain how that works.
Canada has what's called a first-past-the-post system, which means the candidate with the most votes in a riding with the plurality gets the seat in parliament. So the Conservatives could win and did win by really big margins in provinces like Alberta. But if they lose by smaller margins elsewhere, they just don't end up with the seats. And Trudeau actually ran promising electoral reform. This was part of his platform in his 2015 run, and that would make parliament more representational of votes overall. But he walked back on that, and a lot of people haven't been happy with that broken promise.
In the U.S., most of what we heard, Emma, about this election was Trudeau's scandals, the blackface, brownface photos, his ethics scandal. Does his win now mean that all is forgiven?
I don't know that people are thrilled about Trudeau. You know, it's hard to tell what voting is strategic to keep the Conservatives out of power. He did do well in these heavily immigrant ridings outside Toronto where people were questioning how the blackface videos and photos might affect his campaign.
Do Canadian voters think strategically when they enter the polling booths about, you know, what parties might be able to jockey for position, who they cast their vote for? I mean, is it an easy vote to cast?
That was definitely part of what brought Trudeau such an overwhelming majority in Parliament in 2015, is people just really wanted the Conservatives out of power. And when you're in a multi-party system where more people lean left than lean right, but the left can split the vote, strategic voting is very much a part of the Canadian elections.
Emma Jacobs, a multimedia journalist based in Montreal. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Take care.
Cuba remains largely offline. The internet is coming, slowly, bite by bite. As it is, it's not cheap and comes with a lot of state control. The BBC's Will Grant reports on how Cubans are getting online.
In a public access Wi-Fi park in Havana, I met a young gamer in his 20s.
At first,
Ernesto de Armas is, he bashfully admits, probably one of the best gamers in Cuba, excelling in all of the same video games played elsewhere in the world. Yet to do that in a largely offline island like Cuba takes innovation. Ernesto and his friends created SNET, short for Street Network. It was a neighborhood-level intranet, rigged up between homes using cables and... Well, Ernesto can explain.
Well, all kinds of equipment, technological equipment, like devices from nanostation, LAN cables, all kind of things, routers, switches. It was quite complicated.
At its height, SNET existed in cities and towns across the island. That's when the Cuban government decided it was getting too big and shut it down. Ernesto and his fellow gamers protested outside the Ministry of Communications. The government only agreed to co-opt SNET into their state-run youth computing clubs.
We tried to go again to protest in front of the Ministry of Communications. And, well, we were detained, we were threatened, our family... Our friends.
The government in Cuba is at something of a crossroads on internet access. Under the presidency of Miguel Díaz-Canel, access has been increased with 3G now permitted on Cubans' mobile phones and some improved home connectivity. Pro-government blogger Iroel Sánchez summarizes the party line.
Internet sigue siendo un instrumento fabuloso para la investigación científica.
The internet continues to be a fabulous instrument for scientific investigation. It continues to be a fabulous instrument for relations between societies and within societies. The internet is not bad. What's bad is the control of the internet by a few hands and by one single country.
In recent weeks, there was an internet spat in Cuba when Twitter blocked the accounts of scores of pro-government voices, including the head of the Cuban Communist Party, Raúl Castro. Critics of the Cuban government applauded the move, saying they could now see what it was like to be on the receiving end of censorship. However, Eroel Sánchez says the incident was indicative of Cuba's relationship with the US more widely.
Today, we do not interact with the internet. We interact with five companies, which are Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, and Microsoft.
Está vivo en la vida cotidiana de todos los cubanos.
The tension between the government allowing more access but remaining wary of what it might bring is becoming complicated in Cuba. The difficulty for Cuba in terms of internet access is that it hasn't been an evolution, but a revolution. Things barely moved for years, for decades, in fact, and now the demand for change and the government's pace of it are at loggerheads. For now, many are just pleased to have 3G on their phones, but they say the internet needs to be affordable and access permitted in everything from gaming to journalism if they're able to properly wield this revolutionary tool, as Fidel Castro once described it.
The BBC's Will Grant there in Havana. Here's some good news for you cheese lovers out there. There could soon be new varieties of camembert, that quintessentially French cheese. It's all because of an experiment done here in Boston. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
There's a legend about the origins of camembert, and it goes like this. In 1791, a dairymaid in northern France sheltered a priest from the region of Brie. He was running from the guillotine. In thanks, he showed her how to make Brie cheese. She added some innovations of her own, and voila, camembert was born. I'm not sure how true this story is, but the symbolism is obvious. Camembert is the gift of a fleeing priest, i.e. the result of divine intervention. I asked Ben Wolf, a microbiologist at Tufts University and the author of a new study related to camembert, whether he agrees. Is camembert a miracle?
Well, I don't think science can actually answer that question. I think that's a question for more spiritual scholars.
Fair enough. But what Wolf can tell me is that camembert is the result of a special kind of mold, Penicillium camemberti. It only grows in caves in northern France until now, because Wolf and his team were able to make the camembert mold in his lab. What he did is he took an ancestor of the camembert mold, which is found everywhere, and managed to speed up the natural evolutionary process.
So what we did is we took one of these wild blue molds and we put them on cheese in the lab. And every week we gave them fresh cheese over and over and over again. And within about 3 or 4 weeks, they lost all that musty smelling aromas and they began to smell like beautiful, fresh cheese.
This is about more than watching mold transform in a lab, however exciting that may sound. Wolf says in a matter of 5 to 10 years, this experiment could have ramifications for cheesemakers around the world.
The mold that we were using, the wild ancestor mold that we were using, was from Vermont. It was not from France. And so what we are excited by is the idea that we could recreate this domestication process to create a California camembert mold or a Vermont camembert mold. So it suggests a new way to domesticate new strains for cheesemaking.
Cool. I called up Isan Gerdell, the owner of my local cheese shop, Fromaggio Kitchen, to see what he had to say about all of this.
Well, I think it's exciting that people are trying to do new things.
But Isan says nothing can replace real camembert, the camembert from Normandy.
The taste of mushrooms, the texture of the cheese, the luxurious creaminess of it, it's hard to match.
In other words, there's a lot that goes into exceptional cheese. The mold, sure, but there's the milk, the soil, the knowledge passed down from generation to generation, and maybe a little divine intervention. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The World Series starts tonight, the Houston Astros versus the Washington Nationals. The Nationals arrived at the ballpark in Houston today to some familiar tunes. Hey, hey, hey. Merengue, the team's unofficial soundtrack. The Nationals are powered by a host of Latino players, including four from the Dominican Republic.
In the Dominican Republic, we have what we call baseball fever. Baseball is, for us, breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Papi Perez is the editor of a sports newspaper in Santo Domingo.
The fact that several Dominicans are playing for the Washington Nationals and they have the possibility of playing regularly like Juan Soto, that has made people even more interested in the World Series.
Juan Soto is a National star left fielder who's originally from Santo Domingo.
Soto, long ball to left! See you later!
The idol here is Juan Soto. He's a player that's been a surprise for baseball. He established himself in the professional leagues, and now he's leading the Washington Nationals.
The World Series is the dream of many kids in the DR. For them, it's a way out of poverty. There's an expression in the Caribbean, you hit your way off the island.
Those who follow baseball the most are young Dominicans. There are a lot of young men who train in baseball so they can be scouted. They start following U.S. professional baseball from a young age, and the World Series is the best showcase for baseball.
Soto isn't much older than those kids who idolize him.
Soto still cannot celebrate with alcohol. He's only 20 years old and will turn 21 during the World Series.
So, Juan Soto, if you win, there's a glass of champagne waiting for you. Good luck. Finally today, Daime Arocena has been described as the finest young singer in Cuba. High praise, but it doesn't seem to go to her head. When I reached out for an interview, she was abroad in London in the middle of making lunch.
I tried to make a pasta with vegetables and some pork.
Something that you might make in Havana, probably.
Yeah, I mean, I like to cook good food everywhere. At least when it's cooked by myself, it's always going to be amazing.
You're a very modest chef. Del tarot y de sus cartas. Daime Arocena does not need to be modest about her music. Besides, it speaks for itself. Encendiendo la mirada, lo que nadie imaginó, como la luz amaneció. Pero se acabó el amor tras esta intensa tempestad. De grafito color gris se torna la ciudad cuando tú no estás. Daime Arocena has been compared to Aretha Franklin, and not just in terms of talent. Aretha's music, soul, is rooted in the Baptist Church. Daime Arocena's music is rooted in the Santeria faith, a religion forged from Nigerian Yoruba rituals in the New World.
People in Cuba know Santeria's music because it's part of our culture. So it's not just a religious practicing, it's actually a cultural thing. So it doesn't matter if you're a practitioner or not. Everybody knows what it is. Everybody knows how it sounds. Everybody knows how it means for us as humans. Renacer. Volver a vivir.
Corona de reina. Do you think a Cuban audience responds differently to that thread of Santeria running through your music than an American or a European would?
No, I don't miss it because my mission in life is actually bring it to you. I always say in my concerts, I don't want you to believe in what I believe. But this religion is about nature. And for example, all our ancestors used to sing for nature, the song, the rain, for the water, for the earth. That's a natural thing. Mm. So I go around the world, I play my music, I feel I'm doing right, showing to the world what we have got there. Because at the end, it's a beautiful natural energy, it's a spiritual thing, and it's the way that I connect, that I build bridges from my country to different countries. So I don't expect people to know what I sing in United States or Europe, but I expect people to connect with it.
Yeah,
does that
make
sense?
It makes a lot of sense, and I don't know anybody who can't connect with your music. You're adept in pop, in jazz, and classical, and Santeria seems to be the connective tissue. It's always there. I feel it, but I don't know kind of how to describe it to somebody who wouldn't recognize it. So for people who might not know what it is, what is the sound of Santeria? How would you describe it?
Santeria's music is still developing as itself, and not any percussion and song is religious, but most of the Cuban music is inspired in religious music because because it's so rich, it's so tasty, it has a lot of rhythms, it has a lot of melodies, it has a lot of ways to play. So even the style of Latin music that is like response style, like the lead vocalist said something and the choir responds, and that's pretty folkloric music style. So sometimes you don't need a bata drum. You don't need
the big bata drum.
You just need like the feeling, the vibe that at the end is in our blood. So,
I mean, it's interesting because what you were just saying, I was considering all of that while I was listening to your new album, Sonocardiogram. And I just want to know, do you think your music is sacred?
What does sacred mean?
Sacred, I mean, like, kind of based in faith.
What is life without faith? You could not practice any religion, but it doesn't mean you don't have faith. So music is faith. Music is hope. But it's not just about religion. It's about faith in myself, faith in my country, faith in my generation, faith in the music that we are still trying to push from Cuba. Is faith something amazing? And I don't think it is just connected through a religion, because faith is something that is just in our spirit.
Daime Aracena will be in the U.S. next month for several concert dates. Catch her if you can. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.